you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. If you're out driving in the San Fernando Valley, you might already be aware of this, but it's such a big backup. I do want to begin the hour by mentioning it. All westbound lanes of the Ventura 101 freeway are blocked at Haskell Avenue in Encino. There's a standoff between CHP officers and a driver who stopped on the right side of the road and not exiting the vehicle. So the entire freeway is shut down, so just be wary of that if you can avoid the 101 freeway westbound in the area, San Fernando Valley, central area, Encino, and the West Valley area. Just keep that in mind. We turn our attention to open this hour on a ransomware attack on the second largest U.S. meat processing company. JBS said it's made significant progress in dealing with the cyber attacks and expected that the vast majority of its plants would be operating today. But the concern is that we could still see a hike in meat prices and shortages of beef as a result of the ransomware attack on JBS. It is yet another after a significant ransomware attack on a pipeline company, which led to long lines at East Coast gas stations and hikes in prices there and short-term shortages in gas being available. The question is, as these attacks proliferate, what is the U.S. government doing in response, and are companies finding ways of being better able to defend themselves? With us from the Truman National Security Project, which is a national security think tank, former U.S. Army cyber officer, former chief of operations for one of the NSA's cyber centers, Truman Fellow Robert Stasio. Thank you, sir, for being with us today. This again shows the vulnerability of what are essential supplies in this country. Is the motivation strictly financial, or is there more to it than that?
Hi, thanks for having me on. Yeah, we've discovered a lot of single points of failure in our manufacturing industries over the last few months. These types of attacks seem primarily financial related. I know there is a talk of how Russia is connected to this, but it doesn't seem to be as though these attacks are state-sponsored. They're just maybe tolerated in Russia with these criminal actors as long as they're going after Russia's adversaries, right? As long as they don't turn their criminal enterprise onto Russia internally, it's tolerated there, but it primarily seems financially motivated.
Leon Panetta, former director of the CIA and former White House chief of staff, I saw him in an interview this morning, and he was making the point that this is, in a sense, a kind of warfare because the U.S. has to keep, companies have to keep responding to it. And, it's sort of a constant reminder of the vulnerabilities of essential services that can be attacked. And are cyber hackers learning new ways of, with each of these attacks, to get into these systems? In other words, an arms race between the defensive efforts and the hackers' efforts to penetrate?
Good question. There's always the arms race, the cat and mouse game between the attacker and defender, but funny enough, the way that these attacks primarily occur in one of two ways. It's either through a phishing attack, a fake email that's generated by the attackers to try to trick you into clicking it, or it's through some type of remote access. So a company accidentally leaves the door open to their network, so to speak, or a window open that they forgot about, and have an account that they may have leaked credentials on the dark web that the attackers can leverage to get in. And those are primarily the two ways it happens. They can change a little bit. The phishing emails get a little bit more complicated. They can figure out different ways to try to get through that window or that door. But that's pretty much how it's been for the last few years. Those are the primary ways they're getting in.
The other thing we see, of course, is as we've had so much consolidation of industries in this country, a company like JBS, which is the second largest producer of beef, pork, and chicken here in the U.S., for it to shut down for a day, the U.S. loses close to a quarter of its beef processing capacity, or the equivalent of 20,000 cows a day. So with consolidation and a company being taken offline, you can see the effects can be massive, even in a country of this size in the U.S. Let me bring into the conversation Hal Kempfer, CEO of Global Risk Intelligence and Planning, known as GRIP. His management consulting firm is based in Long Beach. He's retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel. Hal, it's good to have you with us again on the program. What are the harms beyond the financial ones for companies that either agree or don't agree to pay the ransom?
Well, Larry, these attacks, and I certainly agree with Robert, you know, they have a financial motive, but they are hitting critical infrastructure. And I think the operative term there is critical. You know, you're looking at Colonial Pipeline that got hit and the disruption all along the East Coast of oil supplies, of course, the price shock to the system. This one, as you just mentioned, and it's not just the meat itself. It's the entire supply chain, everything from going back to farmers growing grain. There is a ripple effect across, which causes inflationary pressure at a time, interestingly, when drought in the West and other severe weather across the country has caused some severe disruption for farmers and their yields. So what you're looking at is a sort of a combination effect, which can have some really big macroeconomic impact on the United States.
And in what ways could the federal government respond to this beyond, you know, assisting companies with beefing up their defenses? Are there ways geopolitically that the U.S. can effectively send messages to countries like Russia, which essentially turn a blind eye, you know, at least turn a blind eye to this?
Well, that's you know, there's an old saying, which is, you know, the difference between Russian organized crime and the Russian government, not much. And certainly the Putinization of Russia, where he uses all facets of his society as sort of a weapon, if you will, or to control everything. But with that, obviously sanctions and stuff. But Liam Panetta was hitting on a key point in an active discussion that's been around for years, but is getting a lot more attention right now, which is, are cyber attacks the same or equivalent to kinetic attacks? And we've always held them, we'll say that rhetorically, but we've never acted like that. But now we're seeing critical infrastructure, major facets of our economy shut down. And so we're looking at this and saying, you know, we need to think of this differently in a political level, but maybe we need to think about this differently in terms of international law, what these attacks are. Of course, that's a double-edged sword because, as you may recall from the Stuxnet, and I'm not saying that we may have been involved, but Stuxnet, you know, shut down the nuclear program in Iran, and that was alluded to being a U.S.-Israeli operation. So, you know, it would potentially hinder our operations globally as well.
Yeah, and the U.S. beyond Stuxnet, as you bring up, has not, to my knowledge, been linked to other major, you know, offensive operations against enemies of the United States. But do you think, Hal, that that's likely where we're going?
I think there's very active stuff going on across the board, and I think we're very reticent to engage in that stuff. We have a lot of reasons, legal, ethical, political, why we don't like to do things like that. Other countries don't. But on the other hand, there's always been, you know, we like to keep our options a little bit open as well. And you may recall there was something during the Trump administration, which looked like we may have been involved in an offensive operation. So, you know, these things do happen.
All right. If you have questions for our guests, we're at 866 893-KPECC or the AirDoc page, kpecc.org. Alex in South Pasadena said it was widely reported in 2017 the NSA lost a hacking tool, Eternal Blue, which was then used by many criminal groups in other countries. With the NSA even having trouble defending itself from cyber attacks, how difficult is it for a private company to defend itself? Robert Stasio?
Yeah, it's challenging. You know, I think what people have to realize is no network is 100% secure. So, you know, I worked at the NSA and I've also currently work in the private sector. And I'll tell you, the government has the best security, bar none, spends the most money on it, but they were still vulnerable, as you pointed out. So it's really about risk mitigation. You know, at my current role, I try to reduce my risk surface as much as possible, such that it makes it very difficult for the adversary to get in. And when they do get in, we can respond pretty quickly. One of the things that companies in the private sector should concentrate on is this concept called mean time to respond. And that's essentially the time it takes for you to respond to an incident and kick a bad guy out. So if a bad guy has a very limited time when they're in your network, they can't crawl around to get to those key pieces of information, steal your data, and lock down your data. So there are certain things that companies can focus on that actually don't cost a lot of money, but really make a big impact. But you should never strive to be 100% secure. You should, you know, strive to reduce your risk surface as much as possible.
And this may be partly what you're getting at. What about the ability to firewall different parts of your computer systems? And, you know, for example, if there's a phishing attack with an employee, that somehow that doesn't have the capability to spread then into the system that's responsible for the operations of the actual meat processing plant. Right. Now, how challenging is it to make all of these different areas fully discrete?
That's a very good point. You know, I'd like to say it's more about resiliency than it is about perfection, as you point out, right? Make it so if inevitably some employee will mess up, they will click on something will happen, but you need to be able to respond very quickly with it and set up your structure. So, you know, just like you have maybe like in a submarine, when one compartment floods, it can be blocked off and segregated from everything else. You isolate that machine, you isolate that system so it can't spread. That's how you have to set up your structure, and then you have to test it. So once you get it in place, you have to kind of put your bad guy hat on for a second and try to get into the network as an adversary would to test and make sure your resiliency is holding up. Sounds easy, but in practice, it can be very difficult in large organizations that are pretty complex and that have gone through a lot of changes over the years.
Norberto tweets at AirTalk, which agencies in charge of responding to cyber attacks and where are their reports? Robert, is that something you could share with us?
Yeah, well, it's actually kind of interesting. So it depends on what you're talking about. From a criminal standpoint, if you want to pursue a criminal prosecution of threat actors, that is generally handled by the FBI. They would conduct an investigation and pursue an indictment against those criminal actors. If it's something where you want to work with, if you're a private sector entity, especially in critical infrastructure, and you want to work with the government to respond to an attack or maybe improve your defenses, you would actually work with the CISA, which is a department under the Department of Homeland Security that has been stood up to help work with the private sector. And there are various other agencies, too. There are private sector entities that work with, like, the NSA and the CIA. They may get briefings. They'll take in some critical infrastructure folks from finance or other places into NSA, give them classified briefings after they're properly vetted and read on, and inform them. So there's a lot of different facets to the government that can kind of come to play. But I would say the most interaction is generally through the FBI from a criminal standpoint and then DHS from kind of a protection standpoint.
All right. I want to thank you very much for joining us and sharing your expertise. That's Robert Stasio, fellow with the Truman National Security Project, and Hal Kampfer of GRIP, Global Risk Intelligence and Planning, where he's CEO. Coming up on Air Talk, we turn our attention to a bill in Sacramento that was designed to make it easier and more consistent for journalists to be able to cover street protests. This came up after the spring and summer saw thousands of protests all across the country and journalists having a very difficult time, in some cases getting access and other times being injured by the officers who were involved in those incidents. We'll talk about the bill in Sacramento and how it's evolved when we continue in just 1 minute.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win, and the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.